To order the Education Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Monday, March 24th, and we are doing a public hearing today on House Bill 5016, which is the state school fund as it relates to the Department of Education budget. And I'd like to welcome everyone here today and thank you all very much for taking time out of your schedule to come and listen to the presentations that we have. We're going to take things a little bit out of order today. And what I'd like to do is ask Susan Castillo, the Superintendent of Public Instruction, Cam Pruce-Brawley, and Richard Jarvis, the Chancellor of the Oregon University System, to come forward. And we would be very much looking forward to your, I think, what we could characterize as a tone-setting discussion for the state school fund. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. We appreciate this opportunity to come before you with a very united message from all parts of our state's education system, and that is that we are here to symbolically say that all parts of our education system are absolutely essential to the future of our state, and wanted to let you all know that we are working together. We are meeting regularly now to try to work together and look for new opportunities for our entire system to be working in a ever-growing, coordinated way to meet the needs of students in our state.
Madam Chair?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't identify myself. Susan Castillo, Superintendent of Public Instruction for the state of Oregon.
I'll soon they forget.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Cam Pruce-Brawley, Commissioner of Community Colleges. And I would echo Superintendent Castillo's comments. We do think that this is a new day, and what we hope to show you is a solidarity around education for Oregon students, regardless of what age they are. We all are being put to the test to stretch the education dollar further and further and make better and better impacts. And we are doing that by, at least within the community colleges, by bridging those students who are coming to us from K-12 as well as those students who are going on to the university system. So look forward to going into considerably more depth in a week or two on our budget. But wanted to be here and pledge to you that we are together attempting to serve Oregon students better.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Richard Jarvis, Chancellor of the Oregon University System, and let me to echo the comments of my colleagues here. I, however, am here to talk entirely about narrow self-interest. It is entirely in my narrow self-interest for Oregon students to be better prepared in our schools, for us to have the opportunity to work with the teachers in our schools, and for us to grow the partnerships that we have with our community colleges. And we believe we're doing all of those things, and we're finding a great spirit of cooperation in doing that. So this is collegiality, cooperation, and the most desperate narrow self-interest for our students and for our faculty. I would share with you, as I'm new to this state, that having worked in a number of other states and studied a number of others, there are states that spend a great deal of time talking about K-16 and erecting systems and procedures to put that in place. I found in my time here in Oregon more real cooperation, and I'm experiencing it now with my colleagues here at this table, than in many systems that have done a great deal to put paper programs together. So thank you for the support you've given us for that, and we will continue to work along those lines. I'm very pleased to be here.
I very much appreciate all the three of you taking time out, and I would venture to guess that this is a historic meeting of the minds here. I think that it also is representative of the spirit that is in this legislative session. I think we recognize the challenge that we have in pulling the budgets out this time with the fall off, the tremendous fall off that we've had in the general fund revenue. And I think that you don't have to work in the budget arenas very long before you realize that with the large percentage of general fund that goes towards education and human services and public safety, being the police and the prisons, that those three budget areas are going to be very, very deeply impacted, and building those budgets is going to be an extremely difficult process. And I think as we have tried to sort through a pathway, a way to come from where we are to the place where we have budgets. We talk a lot about protecting the core services and trying to figure out what it is that's central to state government so that we can try to protect that as we move through this real choppy water that we're in. And it is very gratifying in the education arena, which we have been given the responsibility of legislating budgets for, to see the leaders, the community colleges, the K-12 system, and the higher ed system standing shoulder to shoulder with us as we try to work these issues through. And it is going to be difficult, and setting the priorities and trying to sort through the hierarchy of the mission, I think, is going to cause us all to have to reach really deep down inside of ourselves and try to look into the future and separate what we really need to do from what we would very much like to do. And that challenge has been given to all of us, and I really appreciate your willingness to step into the circle and be part of this.
Thank you.
Are there further comments from members of the committee? Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and good morning to all of you. I would particularly like to say to Mr. Jarvis, is it Mr. or Dr. Jarvis?
Well, doctor, that's fine.
Thank you for choosing Oregon, and we hope that you stay for a very long time. I look forward to our meeting this week, and I also look forward to working with all of you in this spirit of cooperation that you are defining this morning. Thank you.
Further questions or comments? Once again, I can't tell you how deeply I appreciate having you all here. It means a great deal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. No one's sure.
The we'll now Sue McGlashan on. Oh, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I believe then we had planned from the department for me to start out the testimony this morning as you take up the K through 12 budget, and then we have other members from the Department of Education who are also here to present information to you this morning.
So do you want to do your piece first? Okay. Please proceed, Superintendent.
Thank you. Well, my message today as you start your work on the K through 12 budget is, of course, pretty predictable, and that is that our Oregon schools deserve as much help as you can possibly give them. For the last 12 years, we have been demanding more from our schools and giving them less, and amazingly, they have met our demands. We established high standards for what students need to know and to be able to do in math and science and reading and writing. We developed assessments to determine if students were meeting those standards. We asked our schools and particularly our teachers to adjust to those standards and those assessments, and they delivered. More and more students are meeting our standards. The percentage of fifth graders meeting reading standards has gone from 67% in 1996 to 79% in 2001. The percentage of 10th graders meeting standards for math multiple choice tests has gone from 29% in 1997 to 45% in 2001. And, of course, we continue to have among the highest SAT scores in the nation. And Oregonians should also know that around the country, Oregon is held up as a model of how to set goals and measure progress toward those goals. And now the federal government, through No Child Left Behind, is telling all the states that they need to follow in our footsteps in terms of standards and accountability. And the federal government, I can tell you, is very pleased and impressed with what Oregon has been doing. I should note that in addition to having accountability in terms of student performance, and in addition to our student assessments and our state report card, we also have real accountability in terms of how dollars are spent on our schools. Thanks to the database initiative, you can now go online and see in great detail how each school district is spending the money we give them. And we have brought committee members samples of the database initiative reports for schools in your legislative districts. The state school fund, of course, is different from the agency budgets the Ways and Means Committee deals with. In other budgets, the agency that spends the money comes in to tell you how they're going to spend it. The state school fund, by contrast, goes out to 198 school districts. In the past, This has sometimes left legislators feeling pretty frustrated with how that works, feeling like they don't know what really happens to that money when it goes out to the schools. Well, now that information is available in detail at your fingertips. Meanwhile, while we have been demanding and getting better performance and adopting accountability measures, we've been giving schools less. I know you've seen probably 7 different ways of calculating per-pupil spending, and they can be confusing. The ECO Northwest study, which I understand you're going to be seeing shortly, makes an effort to explain the differences between the numbers by comparing oranges to oranges. But there are at least a few facts that are indisputable. As ECO Northwest points out, in 1990, we were spending 4.6% of our total state income on K-12 education. In 2000, we spent only 4.2%. We are spending a smaller percentage of our money on schools now than we did in 1990. If you adjust spending per pupil for the increase in the number of kids who are more costly to teach, the increased numbers of English language learners with more and more different language represented, and the increased number of students with special needs, many with extreme special needs, then by any measure, spending has not kept up with the need. And if you keep in mind that education is very labor-intensive, that workers need health care coverage, and that health care costs rise much more rapidly than regular inflation, it's clear that the money has not kept up with the need. So how is it that schools have managed to do more with less? Well, I think the answer is largely focus and effort. When you give people goals to strive for, standards to meet, they will generally respond by doing their best to meet them. And that's what has happened in our schools. The legislature set the standards. Our schools have striven to meet them. And that has overcome the lack of funding. But focus and effort can take you only so far. And we are now about to take a quantum leap. We and the federal government are demanding dramatic improvements from our schools, and it appears we are about to give them dramatically less money than they need. It's as if we were telling a baseball manager, win 100 games and the series this year, or you're fired, and by the way, you've got to cut payroll by 20%. Well, we can't expect this to work. We as a state have set a goal of 90% of students meeting our standards. The federal government in the No Child Left Behind Act has told us that all children should be able to meet our standards. We cannot expect that to work without a significant additional investment. We can be pretty confident that as we try to move from 79% of fifth graders meeting reading standards to 90% or 100%, we're dealing with kids who need a bit more help, more individual attention, somewhat better trained teachers. We're not going to reach those kids unless we reduce class size and improve teacher training. We have a model that estimates what kind of schools we would need to have to reach our achievement of 90%, or our goal of 90%, and that is the quality education model, which I know you're all familiar with. That model tells us that the cost of reducing class sizes, improving professional development, and taking the other steps we'd need to meet our goals would be, in the next biennium, $6.9 billion. Instead, in the governor's current proposed budget, he has proposed $5 billion. That's $1 billion less, let me repeat, $1 billion less than it would take simply to maintain schools at the level they started at the beginning of this biennium, and we all know there have been cuts to that budget. So that means layoffs, shortened school years, pay cuts, and higher class sizes. And if, as we fear, the actual number will be significantly less than $5 billion, that means lots of layoffs, lots of lost school days, huge class sizes, which would truly undermine the promise of public education in the state of Oregon. Our schools will continue to do all they can, as they always have, but if the figure is $5 billion or less, I don't think it's realistic to expect that we will continue to make the same kind of gains we have in the past 12 years. I promise you that we will continue to leave no stone unturned in looking for efficiencies. We will work with our partners to see how to save money. but we've all been turning over stones for over a year, and we are not going to find $1 billion or more under the next stone. Before I leave today, I want to take advantage of this opportunity to clear up some of the misperceptions that many people have about school finance in the state of Oregon. One misperception is that we're spending more than ever on schools and not getting much of a return on our investment. This is simply not true. As I said before, we are getting a return. Achievement is up, and by any reasonable measure, we are not spending more. Another misperception is that we send money to schools and then we don't know where the money goes. Well, as I said, that is incorrect. The database initiative provides detailed information online about how each school district spends its resources. Another misperception is that somehow, to the extent that we do know where it goes, that it all goes to administration. And this is not true. According to the Secretary of State's audit, which you will see, 8% of school spending goes to administrators. 8%. Principals, vice principals, superintendents, and their staff. And that's a pretty reasonable level. The audit did show, however, that 5% of school spending went to a category labeled business report. That's the human resources departments, it's information technology and services and things like that. The audit did show that our spending in this category seems higher than the national average. So we're taking a look at this category. And one thing that we're doing is putting together a task force of information technology officers around the state to see if there are ways to improve service and save resources by adopting common technology systems. So there may be ways to save a bit of money on administration, but it's not as if we can solve our school funding problems by slashing wasteful administration. Another misperception is that we are somehow spending hundreds of millions of dollars on SIM and CAM. This is not true. COSA recently did a survey, and the Department of Education did a study that showed that in terms of actual cash, plus the time of teachers and other personnel who would continue to exist even if there were no SIM and CAM, the cost of having this assessment system in place is in the $30 to $50 million a biennium range. As a quality assurance budget for a $5 billion investment in K-12, that's not extravagant, and the vast majority of those expenses are, in effect, required by the No Child Left Behind Act. A final misperception in some circles is that the federal No Child Left Behind Act made lots of new money available. I wish that were the case, but it is not. The act has noble goals, but the method the federal government has chosen to implement them relies more on the stick than on the carrot. The state and schools will lose money if we do not comply. It would be much more convenient for all of us if there were a nice, simple solution to our school funding problem. It would be nice if the federal government would help us and bail us out, or if we could solve all of our problems by cutting administration or getting rid of SIM and CAM. Unfortunately, it's not going to be that easy. The only way we're going to solve our school funding problem is to fund our schools. And another point I want to make before I leave today is that as you construct your budget, please remember that every $1 million pays for a year's education for well over 100 kids. When you're thinking of adding $10 million to our schools or subtracting $10 million to our schools, please keep this in mind. Those dollars translate into 1,000 students. Even in a $5 billion budget, every million matters. And finally, Madam Chair and committee members, I want to say, I know that money is tight. I know you can't wave a magic wand and make more money appear. All I ask of you is this. When you produce a budget for schools that is not enough, let the world know that you know it's not enough. And let the world know that our schools have worked hard and they have done great things and they deserve better. Thank you.
Thank you. Before I open it for comments, we have a housekeeping issue that we need to attend to, and that is that because of fire laws, we're not permitted to allow people to stand by the door. There are a couple of empty chairs up here at the side table that people are welcome to use, and we are currently trying to find a location for an overflow room, but we're told that all of the rooms are currently in use. So I think we're in a situation where if people can't find seats, then we need to ask them to leave the room.
Madam,
there's another chair over here.
May I make a suggestion? We have these additional chairs up here that we will not be using for members. Could we also make those?
We could do. Available? We could definitely make use of those.
Thank you.
So please find a seat. The and in addressing your comments, Superintendent Castillo, I do appreciate the spirit in which you offer them, and I think that the only exception that I would take is that we are not going to be the people that make this budget. We are going to be the people that make this budget. This is going to be an issue that we all work our way through. And I think that there is a very clear recognition that the amount of money that we have to divide up in this biennium or in the 03-05 biennium across all of the areas that state government puts money into is we are going to see a major diminishment in the services that we're going to be able to pay for. But we have the job of building the budget on those numbers. There will, I am sure, be a revenue discussion that goes along with this, but that isn't the purview of this committee. The purview of this committee is to build the budgets in the education arena on the level of funding that we can expect to receive in 03-05. And everyone knows that that isn't going to be a very pretty picture and that it's a tremendous challenge to us. And I would ask everyone that's here and everyone that wants to take part in this debate that the challenge is going to be to try to figure out what the priorities are for funding. And that is going to be, I think, an interesting debate. But unless we figure out what it is that we can take off of teachers' plates to free them up to be able to deal with larger class sizes and shorter instructional times and the ability to offer less electives and all the tools that they're going to have in their toolbox, which are not many, unless we can figure out some more tools to give teachers to deal with this, we're going to have failed pretty miserably. And so I look forward as we move through this in shouldering that challenge and coming up with some realistic tools to give people.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. I agree with you and look forward to doing that work.
Further comments?
I have a couple questions.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. Thank you, Superintendent. Regarding your testimony today, how is Oregon doing in their standards compared to No Child Left Behind? Are we integrating what we've already done into what they have done? Are we there yet, or do you know? Because I know it's a very difficult procedure to evaluate.
Absolutely. Madam Chair, Representative Smith, we were in Washington, D.C., a meeting with the Undersecretary Eugene Hickok about a week and a half ago now, and talking with him about how we are implementing No Child Left Behind in the state of Oregon, that we absolutely embrace the spirit of this law, believe it's the right thing to do, and are working very hard to make it work. It does actually fit in nicely with what we already have going in Oregon in terms of the standards and assessment system that we have in place, and they are very impressed with what we have in place and see how the law does fit in with what we're already doing. And in fact, in our conversations there, they even talked about perhaps using Oregon as one of the model states to help other states understand, you know, how to have those kinds of systems and create those systems, because there are some states where they're pretty much starting from ground zero on building, or had to anyway. Many states are far along in that work because they have to be in implementing the law. But so we really are in a good place, but there are a lot of new mandates with that law that we are hoping the federal government is going to be able to help supply some resources for, and we're working with our federal delegation on that one.
Follow-up question.
Follow-up.
In No Child Left Behind, according to your comments, the federal government said that students would reach 100% level. Now, in that, do they include IDEA students in that?
They include all students.
Okay, and what percentage of that are they going to fund for us?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, we are involved in very serious discussions with them. Last week I was also at a conference with my peers from around the country, other superintendents from other states. We went to the White House and met with White House staff, talking with them about how we're all working very hard to implement this law. but that we do need some help on the resource side. We did not get any assurances that that is going to be happening, but we definitely weighed in as states across this country on how that is an urgent plea from us to make this law successful.
So at this point, we really don't know what type of funding we're going to get for this. We have been told, do it, is that correct, by X date, or you will, I'm certain there's consequences.
Absolutely, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, there are serious consequences. If schools do not meet what's called adequate yearly progress, there are serious consequences which end up leading to parents being able to choose other schools, the schools having to provide supplemental services to help students in those schools. It can go all the way to the extreme end of changing staff there, losing funding perhaps if some of the requirements are not met. So there are some very serious consequences, and we are working very hard to try to provide, to put together in place a system of support for schools that will not be meeting adequate yearly progress according to this law, and we're going to do what we can from the department level, working with all of our partners around the state to try to help those schools as much as we possibly can as they're facing some serious sanctions that are going to be coming down the road.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
The Superintendent Castillo, there also is a waiver possibility on No Child Left Behind. Can you talk to the committee a little bit about what the parameters are for getting a waiver to the program?
Madam Chair, I do not believe there is a waiver available. I know there has been talk about possible waivers, but I'd like to turn to Pat Burke, the deputy in the department, for clarification on that. He has been our...
With the caveat that there may be a better place in the presentation to have this discussion, let's maybe just table that.
Okay.
And Senator Gordley has a point. Question.
What thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, let me first say how much I have looked forward to this day and the opportunity to look across at our superintendent of public instruction and to be able to address you in this manner.
Thank you.
It's just a wonderful moment. I just want to say that to you. I would ask for two things as we proceed in these hearings. One, that in the presentations that come to us, that we get a very clear picture of what is happening with those students who have been left behind. And I really appreciate the tone of the superintendent's message. It's an excellent message this morning. But again, give us a clear picture of what is happening to raise the achievement level for those students who have been left behind. The department now disaggregates data by race and ethnicity, of course by gender. But the fact that we now have that disaggregated data, which just came to us last session for the first time, gives us a much better diagnostic tool to assess what is happening with specific populations in our schools and where we need to target, where we need to focus. So what I would ask that information come forward to us. The second comment I have is more of a concern, and it is the fact that the quality education model sets forth a 90% achievement goal, which leaves 10% of kids left behind. And at some point, we need to have a conversation that tells us that we're reconciling that gap with the now 100% achievement goal that is set through the Leave No Child Behind initiative. And I haven't heard yet that the Quality Education Model Commission is ready to make that statement or ready to make that move. If they are, I think that needs to be conveyed to us so that we know that our state policy is on the same track as the federal policy. Is that point clear?
Absolutely. Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, yes, and I absolutely will follow up on both of those points. Just to let you know, one of my top priorities in my administration is putting more emphasis on the work to close the achievement gap in the state of Oregon and really taking a look inside the department at how what we can do in the department to make that a higher priority. You know, take a look at rearranging resources that we have there so that we can put, we can elevate that issue within the department and direct more resources there in that effort and work with new partners and more partners in that effort. I think, you know, this new federal law really does push us forward to do that work, but it's whether the law is there or not, it's the right thing to do, and we absolutely have to make it a higher priority in the state of Oregon. But we will follow up with both your question on the commission's work, and absolutely we'll get that data for you, and we will be using that data. It is very valuable data for us as we try to measure how all kids are doing and track it and be accountable for moving all kids higher up.
And, Madam Chair, just one final comment. One of the things we have failed to do as a legislature is provide enough of an investment in staff development, and particularly for teachers. That's been a colossal failure on our part from where I sit. And so, again, as testimony comes forward through the department, it would be helpful to hear where that failure aligns with where we are not able to do something that better serves students in our classrooms around the state.
Okay, absolutely.
Further questions or comments? Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Superintendent Castillo, and you may not know this number off the top of your head, so if you don't, maybe you could get back to us or to me on this. But I think Representative Smith had a good question about the IDEA and special education funding. What is the amount that the feds would owe us that they're not paying now if they lived up to their original commitment?
Of up to 40% spend support? Do we have someone here from the department who would have? We will get that number for you.
Thank you.
Further questions or comments? Thank you very much, Superintendent.
Thank you.
What I'll do now is move to Sue McGlashan, our legislative fiscal officer, to give us an overview of legislative fiscal's look at the world here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the subcommittee. You've got a couple of packets of information in front of you. One is the department's presentation, which they will cover later, and it's in this teal covered folder. And then from Legislative Fiscal Office, you have a paper or a clipped packet of papers, and that's what I'll be going over right now, just to kind of orient you to what you'll be hearing later on from the department and from others. And again, this is House Bill 5016 for the State School Fund. For those of you who aren't really familiar with the Department of Education's budget, this is just a piece of it, albeit the largest piece of it, but it's just a piece of it. It doesn't cover things like operations, grant and aid, youth corrections, special schools, and those are in other bills which you will be considering later in a few weeks. This is just for the State School Fund. So I'd just like to go over the items on the first handout, which at the top says House Bill 5016, State School Fund, and then Legislative Fiscal Office Orientation and Background. And under that first item, agency role, budget size, revenue sources, and budget drivers, what I've done there is just pointed out that the presentations from the department and also from the Department of Administrative Services Budget and Management Division will cover those items later. So in order to not be repetitive, I haven't provided any detail right there. I've also indicated there, though, that the second item, the LFO analysis of the governor's budget, does have information about things like revenue sources, budget drivers, and budget size. And that's been provided to you, by the way. It's the page behind the one we're looking at now with the table at the top. And I would just point out that it talks about revenue sources and relationships, again, budget environment, and then goes into some detail about the governor's budget, and then it does have a table in there with some historical data about state support for K-12 education. And then item number three pertains to budget notes, and included in the budget report for Senate Bill 5514 from the 2001 session, and that was the state school fund legislation or appropriation legislation, were two rather lengthy budget notes relating to using certain data in developing a budget for the state school fund. And I have put the two budget notes in there. I won't read them, but I do want to point out that the department did submit a report as directed, a combined report to satisfy both budget notes. And this report was submitted to and acknowledged by the Emergency Board in November 2002. And I've provided a copy of their report for you, and that's the third handout in the LFO packet. And then if you'd flip the page over, you'll see item number four is audit reports. I've listed one there, a report that was issued this biennium by the Audits Division, and that is the Oregon Department of Education Kindergarten through 12th Grade Cost Survey. The Audits Division will report on the results of this survey on Wednesday of this week, and in your packet I've provided a copy of the report so that you can review it prior to their presentation. Under interim reports and studies, there are a number of reports listed there. There are two in particular that I'd like to point out. The first one, a report from a task force established during the interim, the Revenue Options School Funding and Accountability Task Force. Again, this report is provided to you, and the legislative revenue officer will be presenting this report tomorrow towards the end of the two-hour time slot for the public hearing, and so that you can review the report prior to its presentation. I've provided that to you. And finally, the last report that I've provided to you is the Comprehensive Analysis of K-12 Education Finance in Oregon by Echo Northwest. And this report will be provided to the subcommittee on Wednesday also. And if you're interested in any of the other reports that are listed here, please let me know, and I can certainly get a copy to you. And then the other item I would just point out to you is number eight, relevant issues, trends, or special challenges. You'll hear about some of these during the presentations coming up, things like special session reductions, assumptions in the governor's budget regarding salary and other inflationary increases versus actual district experience, changes in student demographics, the federal No Child Left Behind Act, and then effects of the equalization process over the last 10 years or so. So that wraps up my orientation, and I believe the department is ready to come up then and do their presentation.
Questions or comments for Ms. McGlashan on her presentation? Thank you. Mr. Burke and Mr. Reeder. Ah. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For your record, my name is Pat Burke, and I'm the Deputy Superintendent for Educational Policy for the Oregon Department of Education. My colleague, Brian Reeder, and I are delighted to be with you this morning as we begin this very important conversation, what I'm sure will be a long and detailed conversation on the State School Fund. We really appreciate the opportunity to open this conversation this morning, and I would like to reiterate one key point that we've tried to demonstrate in preparation for this meeting and certainly our intent as we move on, and that is our agency's commitment in working in partnership with this committee throughout this process in order to provide the best information that we can for you and to assist in any way that we can in this vitally important work that we all are facing together. In this opening presentation, we would like to accomplish four major objectives. We'd like to review with you briefly the goals of education that are set forth for the state. We would like to look at how districts get and spend their money. We'd like to look at what results taxpayers are getting in return for their investment. I've listened to some of your questions this morning. I'd try to answer some of them, Madam Chair, as we move through some of this material. And finally, we want to look at outcomes that can be expected from some of the decisions that are facing this committee.
Could I interrupt you just one moment? To the ladies that don't have chairs, please come and take these chairs up here. We won't ask you any questions, but we need to have everyone seated. I'm very sorry to interrupt you.
That's no problem, Madam Chair. Thank you. I'm referring now to page 3 in the handout in the teal material that you have.
Page 3.
Oregon has a very long and, I think, remarkable history and a strong commitment to its children. On November 9th of 1857, the people of the Oregon Territory, that was 2 years before statehood, voiced that commitment to a uniform common education for all children in the state when they approved the Oregon Constitution. So from our very beginning, we have had a strong and fundamental commitment to work as a collective in looking after the welfare of our children, and that has continued throughout our history. We set very high goals for our education system. In 1991, the Oregon legislature passed the Oregon Education Act for the 21st century, calling for the state to establish a world-class educational system for all children in the state. Oregon law calls for the establishment of a system that does 4 things: that promotes academic excellence among its students, that provides for rigorous academic standards for all children, that provides opportunities for students to apply what they have learned, and finally, to provide the skills and knowledge necessary to support learning throughout our graduates' lives. I believe our goals are very clear. We must have an educational system in our state through which all students must be equipped with the information and skills necessary to pursue their future life choices, a system through which all students should be motivated and challenged to pursue both rigorous, serious scholarship and to have experience in applying their knowledge and skills in real and meaningful ways in order to demonstrate their achievement, and that all students should acquire lifelong learning skills that prepare them for an ever-changing world. A brief anecdote, Madam Chair, if we consider for a moment what's happened in the lives of our children today. Students that will graduate from our high schools this year in 2003 began kindergarten in the 1991-92 school year. That was before internet, before email, before digital cameras, before CDs and DVDs and MP3s, before the types of changes in our business structure, our relationships around the globe, the types of changes that we've seen throughout our society. If you just think of what changes occurred from the time our students entered kindergarten to now, there are students that are leaving our high schools today and going on to college and university programs and indeed on to careers that simply did not exist when they started school. And we have to consider what that will look like in another decade as another group of kindergarten students begins school this year. Now, looking at the next slide, education in our state is a very big enterprise. As you can see on the slide, we serve approximately 540,000 students in 1,250 schools in 198 school districts and 21 intermediate education service districts. We employ approximately 35,000 teachers and educational assistants in the state and an additional 18,600 support staff. These are members who serve in a wide variety of roles, from superintendents, principals, assistant principals, counselors, librarians, clerical workers, cafeteria workers, bus drivers, maintenance workers, and many more. All of these employees, and I believe this very strongly, all contribute their special efforts to make our schools as successful as they possibly can. And looking at the next slide, based upon the research that we do on what what can schools do to work well and to be more efficient, and indeed on strong legislative direction? We have demanded that schools do better in our state and demanded that they prove that they are doing so. A high-quality education system must be based upon clear, high expectations for all students. We have to have accurate measures of whether our students are meeting those expectations and using the information for both accountability purposes and for planning for improvement. Schools in Oregon are based upon a very good system that measures what a student knows and can do. Oregon has been recognized, as the superintendent mentioned a moment ago, for having consistently high-quality standards. A key factor in Oregon standards is that they are indeed Oregon's standards. They were created by Oregon teachers and community members and are based upon what we know to be the needs of our children. We also have a very high-quality system for measuring if our students are learning what we teach. This system is a comprehensive one, and based upon our commitment to having students apply what they have learned, it contains both tests and work products, such as writing samples and speeches and written solutions to complex mathematics problems. Every school in the state is required to prepare and revise a school improvement plan that utilizes this information on student results. And by law, they do this with the direct involvement of parents, teachers, classified employees, and community members through local site councils. These data are used at a district level so that each district can submit a district improvement plan, and at the state level, we use the information for planning purposes to support districts and what they need and for accountability purposes. Now, the result is a system of both review and decision-making for improvement and accountability purposes that makes very significant use of data. And as the superintendent remarked this morning, federal No Child Left Behind discussions with the U.S. Department of Education has revealed strong support for Oregon's use of data. We currently provide assessments at grades 3, 5, 8, and 10. The federal government has approved the Oregon system for purposes of the No Child Left Behind Act. And in response to Representative Smith's question, we will be, Representative Smith, adding the assessments at grades 4, 6, and 7 as required in the federal law, so we'll have a system of third grade through eighth grade of annual assessments. Now, looking at the next slide, we are able to use this rich body of information to examine and report on Oregon schools in a variety of ways. First, state standards and assessment reports. These are the reports that receive the most attention, and Madam Chair, these are the ones you're probably most familiar with. These are the reports that you see in the newspaper. Various reports on school and district performance. They are easily attainable on our website and are posted by most schools in the state. Secondly, the Oregon Report Card was created by the Oregon Legislature 4 years ago. Every school in the state is rated on a 5-level scale from exemplary to very low, utilizing a variety of pieces of information. Again, a complete list of all of this information is easily attainable on the Oregon Department of Education website. The superintendent mentioned the database initiative. This is another very powerful tool that lets us compare costs across districts and indeed across schools using common definitions of key characteristics. Every district is audited on an annual basis, and their expenditures are balanced against their membership. And I'm going to list, and you see on the material, the No Child Left Behind Act, even though this is a federalist system. But the No Child Left Behind Act is really all about accountability. And we list this law under our accountability measures because we believe that Oregon is also about accountability. And the federal No Child Left Behind requirements are reinforcing what we are doing. And as to the question of waiver, Representative Smith, we will investigate that further. Our understanding of the waiver requirements currently is that the requirement for adequate yearly progress is not waivable, but what is waivable is flexibility to utilize funds across categories. The state has flexibility to move from title to title, but the requirement around accountability is not waivable. This gives you a brief look, Madam Chair, what we are demanding from our schools and how we are monitoring progress. We'd now like to look at what we are giving our schools to accomplish these ambitious goals. And I'd like to turn to my colleague, Brian Reeder.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, for the record, I'm Brian Reeder with the Department of Education School Finance Office. In looking at what we're giving to our schools in terms of financial support, I'd like to sort of set the stage here by giving you some historical context. The bar graph in front of you shows the level of support through both state and local funding over the past 15 years. The darker shaded gray bar on the bottom being local resources and the lighter top half of the bar being state resources. And the graph shows a couple of things that I think we all know, but it's worth reiterating, and that is that we've had a dramatic shift in Oregon in where the money comes from for schools. As you can see, the dark gray bar representing the amounts generated through local revenue, primarily property taxes, falls dramatically starting in 91-93 biennium all the way through 97-99, and this is a direct effect of the limitations placed on property taxes both by Measure 5, which passed in 1990 and became first effective in the 91-92 school year, and then later in 1997 with the passage of Measures 47 and 50, which further reduced property taxes in Oregon and limited the growth rate in assessed values, which really limits the growth in property tax revenue at the local level. At the same time, you can see that the light gray bar has increased in size quite rapidly, increasing from $1.9 billion in 91-93 to $4.7 billion in 01-03. Overall, we've seen increases in funding in school funding in Oregon over this period, increasing from around $5 billion in the start of the period to roughly $6.8 billion today. Now, given these increases, a number of people have said, well, we're giving more money than ever to schools. What's the problem? Why are you saying we have a funding crisis? And I think if we look at the next slide.
Just for one moment, Mr. Reeder, Ms. McGlashan has some information that I would also like to have introduced into the public record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to point out on that slide 7, the title of it is State School Funding, State and Local Revenue, and I believe if you compare this chart to the chart in the LFO analysis, you'll see some differences, particularly for the 97-99, 99-01, and 01-03 biennia. And I believe that's because the chart on page 7 of the department's handout does not include lottery bond proceeds that were given to schools in the 97-99 biennium of $150 million. Is that correct, Brian?
Madam Chair, yes. The dollar amounts shown here are funds distributed through the state school fund. So Sue's correct. Those lottery dollars were not distributed through the state school fund, so they are not included here. So that is a slight difference between the two sets of numbers that you'll see. I think, though, the trend here is what's important, and including those lottery dollars in here would increase these dollar amounts slightly, but really would not change the trend significantly.
Madam Chair, I agree with that. I just like to further clarify then for 99-01, there were lottery bond proceeds and Senate Bill 622 proceeds for technology expenditures distributed to schools. And then I believe the 0103 amount here does not reflect the potential accrual that school districts could do.
That's correct.
They so choose. So those are differences you might see if you were to look at this chart and then try to compare it to the one in the LFO analysis.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And I would bring this information to the table in the spirit of having people understand how difficult it is to make apples-to-apples comparison. It's incredibly important that the basis of the numbers be laid out along with the numbers. Mr. Reeder.
There really are three things that have driven the really dramatic increases in the state funding of schools, and here I'm focusing on the state portion of the funding that goes out through the formula. The first one is what I pointed out in looking at the previous graph, and that is local revenues have really dropped quite dramatically over the decade, particularly in the first 6 years as Measure 5 phased in and then measures 47 and 50 became effective. The state responded to that by increasing the state's share of school funds quite significantly in the early part of the decade. Roughly 30% of the funding came from the state and 70% from local revenues. Those percentages have now been reversed, roughly 70% coming from the state and 30% from local revenues. In looking at the total funding, though, a couple of adjustments need to be made in looking at the gross dollars, which are shown in this graph. First adjustment really is for inflation. Over this period, inflation, in this case...
Mr. Reeder, could I interrupt one more time? Representative Bates has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we have a lot of work to get through and there's a lot of people here. Do we have public testimony today, too?
No, we don't. We have public testimony.
I want to ask...
Thursday night and Thursday.
I'd like to ask a couple questions about the slide of page 7 first before we leave it. We've had a decrease in local revenue coming in because of ballot measure 5. I wonder if you could break that down for the committee at a later time, showing how much of that was because of a reduction in income from commercial real estate compared to residential real estate. I was 10 years on a school board, and I'm pretty closely affiliated with them yet, and most of the loss of income locally for us was not from people's homes. They didn't see a substantial decrease in their taxes, but from commercial real estate. And I commonly use example in my own office, whereby my own personal taxes on a commercial building dropped from $5,000 to $2,500 in 1 year after the ballot measure 5 came in. So I think breaking that out might be helpful for the committee. I also want to know what the long-term trend is considered to be. Are we going to be flat on this? Do we expect to see as the values of homes, commercial property goes up, even with the ballot measure 50 effect, do we expect to see the amount of money coming in from the local property tax to substantially increase, stay level, or drop in the future? That would be helpful to us.
Madam Chair, Representative
Bates. Do you wish to comment on these things now, or do you wish to do some backgrounding and get back to the committee?
Madam Chair, I can comment briefly. First, Representative Bates is correct. We have seen in some communities, although not all communities, we have seen larger cuts in property taxes for commercial property than for residential. In many communities, residential property taxes really didn't change much at all. Well, my property taxes are the same they were 12 years ago. Now, that some argue that meant we didn't get a cut, but with inflation, my property taxes should be double what they are. So in real terms, residential property taxes have been cut. Commercial property taxes have been cut even more. And there's a lot of variation from community to community. In terms of what to expect in the future of property tax revenues, right now for most properties, residential and commercial, assessed value is below market value, so there's still room for assessed values to grow, even if market values don't. And we're still seeing, although less today than we did during the 90s, additional new construction. So I think we'll probably see continued growth in property tax revenue in the order of between 3 and 5% a year. And at some point, we can all hope that market values start to go back up, but if they don't, at some point, assessed values will catch up with market values, and there won't be any more room for growth in assessed values because they cannot exceed market values. I personally don't believe that will happen. I think we'll start seeing market values go up again probably this year or next year, so we can continue to see 3 to 5% growth in property tax revenue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Please proceed, Mr. Reeder.
Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Senator Mesley.
I'm a little slow on the uptake this morning. I think that's an interesting comment, Mr. Reeder, but that varies considerably throughout the state, I'm sure, on the growth of valuations. And I would be very interested in the impact between some of our different communities, high-growth communities, as well as loss of enrollment communities. And along with that, I'd be very interested in information as to the loss of enrollment over the past 10 years of our districts across the state, as well as those that are fast-growing or showing growth and how fast they're growing. And I think it would be extremely important to also know, have some understanding in this process, what that impact has on the schools, both in their offerings, the programs that they are able to offer, as well as the class size.
Madam Chair, Representative Meserly, certainly we can provide that information to you. We do have very good data at the individual district level and actually a great deal of data at the individual school level. And the Department of Revenue does have very good data on property tax revenues and the trends over time, so we certainly can provide that.
Okay, thank you.
Please proceed.
In addition to inflationary pressures over the decade, we've also seen enrollment growth in Oregon schools, averaging slightly below 1% a year over that period. But clearly that enrollment growth has varied tremendously around the state. We have, and we'll look at a slide a little bit later on this, roughly two-thirds of our districts are losing enrollment. Another 10% are what we would consider stable, and that they're maintaining their enrollment or growing fairly slowly. And then, 25% are in that category, and 10% are what we would term rapidly growing districts, and those are predominantly in suburban Portland, but also in some other parts of the state, Salem among them, where enrollments are growing quite rapidly. Resulting in a statewide growth of about 1% a year. When you combine inflation and enrollment growth and look at resources available to schools on a per-student basis, as we show in the next graph, what we see is that the funding of schools really has not kept up with inflationary pressures. In 1990-91, state and local revenues distributed through the formula, and actually in that year, that year predated the formula, but we have equivalent data to look at spending on the same basis. State and local revenue was roughly $6,778 per student.
Could I interrupt and ask you, just for the clarification of the people on the committee and the people looking at this graph, can you explain how you inflation adjusted these numbers?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, yes. The adjustment for inflation that I used in these numbers uses the Portland Consumer Price Index. And essentially what that tells us is how much less a dollar buys today than it bought in 1990-91, given the trends in prices in the Portland area. Over that period, the the consumer price index in Portland increased slightly over 50%, meaning that it would take $1.50 today to buy what a dollar bought in 1990-91.
Representative Bates.
Madam Chair, thank you. Is there a statewide index we can use? Does one exist?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, no, there really isn't. The consumer price indexes are developed by the U.S. Department of Commerce, and they do them for major metropolitan areas, but they do not do them for states.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
How big a city do you have to be to have one? Does Medford have one? Does Eugene have one? Does Coos Bay have one?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I believe the only index for a metropolitan area in Oregon is for the Portland area, which now encompasses Salem as well, although I'm not certain of that. There may be indexes for those for Eugene and Medford. I would have to check on that.
Would you like to make the inevitable comment here?
No, I'm not going to. I'm going to control myself. The numbers we're seeing here, this is for the part of the program that is school fund. Have we ever combined those figures to look at the local funds coming into it and look at that to see how it affects inflation?
Chair Morgan, Representative Bates, these amounts here do include local revenues. These include all the money going out through the formula, which is local plus state school fund revenue.
Thank you.
Ms. McGuire.
Madam Chair, thank you. If I could just make a comment related to Representative Bates' earlier question about the CPI. The Legislative Revenue Office also does calculations of ADMR and ADMW adjusted for inflation, and that office uses the U.S. CPI, believing that it's a more appropriate factor to use.
So we'll be seeing data then from sort of...
If you were to look at the Legislative Revenue Office's calculations, you would see a difference between that and what the department has provided. Just
would it be possible then, Ms. McGlashan, to have a graph on the using the national inflation numbers to do this? I'm curious if it would parallel or if it would be any different.
Madam Chair, I believe the difference you'll see is in the actual numbers that are calculated. I believe the trend would be the same, and I think very similar.
When we were looking at how to inflation adjust these, we tried several different things, and all of them showed the same trend, which I think is an important point to make.
That's the point that I'm sure they're trying to make. I just want as much information as we can get.
But I think that also the point that we need to make, and I think that Senator Meserle alluded to it too, is that there really is two Oregons going on here. You have one situation evolving in the top end of the Willamette Valley, and then for most of the rest of the state, you face quite a different scenario. And the impacts on the education and the school system itself are quite different. But that's kind of an aside from where you're going, so please continue going there.
Thank you. To sort of conclude what the information on this graph, it shows that between 1990-91 and 02-03, which is the current school year, on an inflation-adjusted per-student basis, the state school fund is providing roughly $650 per student less than it did in 1990-91. That's about a 10% decrease. Keeping in mind that the 02-03 numbers do include the amounts, roughly $378 per student, that districts are allowed to accrue back from 03-04. If we were to take those dollars out of the 02-03 number here, that would bring it down to $57.48, which is roughly 15% below the level we were at in 99-01.
Representative Smith has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Reeder. I guess I'm still not satisfied with this graph and what it actually reflects. You said you use the Consumer Price Index of Portland. But doesn't the funding per student, isn't that directly affected by huge inflationary pressures that's unique to education in that the PERS, we know what PERS has done, and we know what a cost of our medical benefits has done. So is that also calculated into as inflationary pressure? Because your page 8, inflation, personnel, salaries, and benefits. So if we were to get PERS under control, somehow slow down the increase in the rising cost of medical benefits, these figures don't indicate that. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, that's correct. The inflation adjustment in this graph is based on a consumer price index, which really takes into account the rising cost of consumer goods. Embedded in those rising costs are health benefits, salaries, and so forth that private businesses have to provide in order to produce their products.
Okay, but the state benefit package is much different than the private sector. I think it's much more generous. PERS is much more generous than what's going on in the private sector on its current funding. So I don't see how you can use the CPI of Portland and have it pertain accurately to the state school funding.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, obviously what we would like to have here is something akin to a education cost index, which would be a more accurate reflection of how costs have risen in the education sector to adjust these spending levels. We don't have one of those. So as a proxy for that, we use the Consumer Price Index. Now, some of the research that has been done in trying to develop a cost index shows, I think, very clearly that costs in the education sector have risen faster than they have
Absolutely.
For consumer prices in general. So
Absolutely.
The effect of that, if we were to reflect that in this graph, it would show that spending today is even lower than portrayed here than it was in 1990-91.
Madam Chair, what I would like to see, I would like to see a graph like this with actual dollars spent, not inflationary adjusted dollars, because I think that gives us a truer picture.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, we can certainly provide that graph to you, keeping in mind, though, that if you look at spending over time and don't adjust for inflation, you will get a distorted picture of the real resources being devoted to any particular activity. That's why we adjust for inflation.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, though, maybe you can clarify a point for me. The budget that we're supposed to put together for the K-12, do we take, are we funding in that budget inflationary pressures through the 05 legislative session? Is what I want to know.
The challenge that we face is to take the available funding that we have and use it to address the needs of the state school fund and the K-12 education system. And I think one of the problems that you're bringing forward is one of the problems that all of the Ways and Means Committees are going to be grappling with this time, and that is that it is very, very difficult to take what is going on in reality here in all of the areas that the state funds and translate it into something on paper that's absolutely true from everyone's point of view. It's very difficult to do that. And so what you do is you get a picture that somebody thinks is a very honest stab at doing that, and then you have these kinds of discussions to talk about the strengths and the weaknesses of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would just submit that it's very hard for me to look at a voting member on this committee at this graph and make any assumptions on true inflationary pressures, you know, based on the calculations and how he arrived at these figures.
And there will be, in Mr. Reeder's presentation, a discussion on the pressures that the system is undergoing, and definitely the cost of providing health insurance coverage to the employees and the cost of the public employees' retirement system are two of the huge pressures that this system is under, and we need to grapple with that.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Another factor that's really driving costs in schools, not just in Oregon, but throughout the country, is increasing shares of students who have higher needs.
Yes.
And the two in particular that have seen dramatic growth are special education students and students whose first language is not English. In trying to account for the growth in those students in looking at funding, one way to do that is, rather than using actual students as the measure of in the per student calculations, to use weighted students, that the definition of a weighted student that we use in the state school fund, which gives an extra weight for a special ed student and an extra half weight for ESL students and some additional weights for other categories. The next graph is the same type of graph that we just looked at, the bar graph, but using weighted students as the measure of the per per-student calculation here. And what this shows is even a more dramatic decline in spending over this period, falling from, and my numbers are a little small here, so I'm not sure I can read them, 5874 in 1990-91 down to 4988 in 02-03, a decline of about 15%. Again, the $211 million that districts are allowed to accrue back to 02-03 is included in here. That's about $309 per weighted student. Taking that amount out would result in a decline of roughly 20% over this period. So I think this gives you a picture of really the real resources available through state and local revenues that school districts have. That level of resources has declined dramatically since 1991.
Representative Biggs.
Madam Chair, it would be helpful for me to see the weighting program you've used for this. You used to have formulas that included pregnancy rates and pregnant teenagers. We had special ed kids in that. We had English as a second language in that. And I know you calculate all that in there. I'd like to see how you're calculating it now and see what the trend's been over the last few years. If we're seeing higher pregnancy rates, more, I know we're seeing more English as a second language kids. And that would help us see the trends going through the system on that. That's a little more detail, but I'd like to see if you could get it together for us.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, certainly we can provide that. We will, later on in the slides, we will look at both special ed and ESL students. But we certainly can provide the others as well.
Thank you.
Mr. Reeder, if I might interject too, it may be interesting for the members of the committee, the database that you have a great role in managing has some limitations in the depth of the data that's available to look at across the districts. Can you just take a couple of minutes and talk to the members of the committee about what the strengths and the weaknesses are in that database?
Madam Chair, yes. As I'm sure you all know, starting about 5 years ago, the Department of Education started gathering in a very methodical, comprehensive way data from school districts on their revenues, their spending, characteristics of their students, a number of other data elements, and they all reside in a database that we call the DBI, or Database Initiative. That was the term applied to that project. The great strengths of that are that we now have, for every district in the state and for every school in the state, individual school building in the state, we have some very detailed expenditure data. Where the expenditure categories are defined in a common way across all districts, something that prior to this project we did not have. That probably is the greatest strength of the database initiative, is defining things in a common way. The major weakness is, clearly, we've only been doing this for a few years. We have statewide, we have data for every district in the state right now, only for 3 years, with the fourth year in the process of being validated and cleaned up and put in the database. For 2 years prior to that, we collected the data for 16 pilot districts. So for those 16 districts, we have 5 years' worth of data, soon to be six. But it really does represent a very ambitious and, I think, successful effort to collect data that is comparable across districts and across schools and across time as well. And as we get more years, we'll start to be able to do some even better trend analysis than we can do now.
It, well, and I do think that this is a very powerful management tool for the system, where you can do thing, look at trends in a whole lot of different areas. And I know that the small amount of time that I've spent with you becoming familiar with how it works is that there is a tremendous detail of information in there. And because it is all aligned across all the districts, it's easy to access and build a query based on any of the data points. But and this will, I think, in the future continue to become a more powerful management tool. But I would caution the committee members that it is, because of the shallowness of the data pool right now, very difficult to use it for trending at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Mesrley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is an area that I'm very much interested in, as I'm sure the rest of the committee is. And I'm very concerned, I guess maybe a stronger word to say, for the special ed and the education for the disabled and the mainstreaming that we do. I would be extremely interested in input we can get from the education community as to the impact on the students and as to the impact of mainstreaming, I'm speaking, on the class in general. And are we doing the proper things for the disabled and the special ed students by pushing so hard to mainstream? I'm also, and this goes back to when I served on school board, I'm also very interested in the cost of the health cost of some of these students. And I've felt very strongly from my time on the school board those costs should be borne by the Department of Health Services and not by the school districts. And I know that's a huge cost to many school districts. But I've heard back, Madam Chair, from many of my constituents who say, you know, we're really not doing the right job with our disabled and our severely disabled and some of our special ed classes. And I think this is an ideal time to step back, take a look at it. Does mainstreaming in most cases, if not all cases, really make a lot of sense? Is my bottom line question.
Well, and also let me preface Mr. Burke's comment from just to kind of bring this back down to the place that this isn't a policy committee, Senator. This is a number crunching committee.
Madam Chair, it costs money, though.
Mr. Burke.
Madam Chair, Senator Mesrley, I appreciate your comment, Madam Chair, but policy and number crunching frequently go together.
I will concede that.
I just want to take this opportunity to welcome Senator Mesrley's question and to inform the committee that the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA, is the second largest source of federal revenue to schools, and that act is before Congress this year. It is reauthorized every 6 years, and as a matter of fact, the House introduced a new set of proposed regulations just last week. So our agency has set up an internal task force to analyze the proposed regulations and their fiscal impact, and would certainly welcome any questions and or feedback from the committee as we work with our congressional delegation in Washington in trying to sort this out. This is the highest priority before Congress. Last session was the No Child Left Behind Act, and they intentionally moved reauthorization of IDEA into the current session of Congress, and that debate is underway right now.
Thank you. Follow-up,
Senator. If I can do a follow-up, a little bit unrelated, but it will tie together. As you just mentioned, Mr. Burke, the federal program, No Child Left Behind, and it's probably in our stacks of material here someplace, but I haven't found it yet. What kind of a time frame the federal government is requiring, and are we allowed to show progress, or do they actually have checkpoints of what the standards we have to meet over a time frame?
Madam Chair, Senator Mesley, the answer is that indeed there is a time frame in the law. It is a 12-year time frame beginning with the 2001-02 school year and ending in the 2013-14 school year. And over that period of time, the federal law requires that all students in four subgroups, special education being one of the subgroups, limited English proficiency being another, students on the basis of poverty is a third, students with limited English proficiency is the fourth. So in those four subgroups, each of those groups and taken as a whole must achieve 100% proficiency by the 2013-14 school year.
Thank you.
Looking at some of the key cost drivers in education in Oregon on the next slide, slide 11, and I think this is the issue that Representative Smith may have been alluding to, we are seeing very rapid increases in health insurance costs on the order of 12-15% a year. Some districts have responded to that by setting caps and passing on some of the cost increases to their employees. I think we're going to see more of that. The other one, obviously, is PERS. It's important to note, though, that the PERS problem we're facing right now is something that came up just in the last couple of years, although the seeds of this problem were planted much earlier. But the consequences of the PERS problem really are a new thing. We didn't see really any rate increases in PERS contribution rates through the 90s. They weren't required because the stock market was growing so rapidly. With the fall in the market, that's really the source of our problem and the fact that no reserve was built during those fast growth years.
Mr. Reeder, would it be a fair statement to say that actually with reference to PERS, that the 2003-04 funding cycle is going to be the first major impact that's felt by that?
Madam Chair, I think that's probably correct. I think that the real costs are about to arrive.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure this is the proper time to ask this question because I'm not sure what all you have coming forward for us. And if later in your presentation in the next few days we're going to talk about health care costs for employees, I would like to have some information about whether it's ever been considered to have a statewide health insurance program for all state employees, including district employees. And if there's ever been a discussion about self-insurance, these are both things that have been dramatically done in other areas to reduce health care costs. I wonder if that discussion has ever occurred.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, yes. In fact, there are a couple of bills that have been introduced that would tie school district employees into this current state system. In terms of self-insurance, I know that we have a couple of districts who do that now, and there are also, I believe, is for smaller districts are able to participate in a pool where they, by combining their districts, they are able to get better rates by having more employees. But certainly this is an area that will be explored.
No, Madam Chair, I'll wait and get more details later.
Mr. Reeder, please proceed.
Another key issue, and I think Senator Meserly mentioned this, was declining enrollment districts. We have roughly two-thirds of the districts in Oregon are losing enrollment, and that presents a number of challenges to them. Funding probably the key challenge. When a district loses students, they lose on the order of $5,000 for each weighted student that they lose, but their costs really don't decline by that much because they have certain fixed costs that they need to cover independent of how many students they have. So as they lose enrollment there, those fixed costs become a greater and greater share of their total. And it has presented a real problem. Portland, I think, is a very good example of that. It's a very large district that's losing enrollment and really has generated some very severe funding problems for them.
If I might interject here, I think that those of us that do represent parts of the state where there are those kinds of districts are often faced with the awkward position where you're losing enrollment, but you don't lose a whole fourth grade class. You lose a few kids across the spectrum of the service provision, and it has some very special challenges relating to fixed costs, but also relating to how you allocate your payroll dollars.
Madam Chair.
Senator Mesley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to point out, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a two-year, in present law, there's a two-year delay, I believe, before that impact. And with that begs the question for districts that have had a prolonged loss of enrollment. In my opinion, they simply can't catch up. They can never catch up. And some of my districts in my Senate district have been losing enrollment for 20 years or more. And so it's just a multiplying effect that they can just never really get ahead of, for the same reason that you just mentioned, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
I'm sorry, Mr. Burke has a point.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick observation to support what Senator Messerly said. There is a compounding factor in our state in the rural and small nature of many of our districts, so that when the declining enrollment occurs, one logical thought is, well, let's close a school and combine. If I'm in a single school district or if the next neighboring district is 50 to 100 miles away, this makes this kind of administrative solution very difficult to accomplish. So many of those schools and districts do continue to face declining enrollment without much in the way of a combination of schools as a possible solution.
Good point. There, I think, are only so many hours in a day that we are willing to see students travel on buses.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. Will we get some detail on which districts are affected, and then also some additional information that tells us why this is happening, where it's happening?
We have so hopelessly derailed.
Back to cost drivers. Another key driver, which I mentioned earlier, are changes in demographic characteristics of students. We're seeing very rapid growth in the number of special ed students and the number of ESL students. And then finally, the costs of maintaining older buildings really are much higher than those of maintaining newer buildings, and we have many districts in the state that haven't built a new building in 20 or 30 years, even longer, and so we've got school buildings that are at this point quite old and might even be deemed inadequate, and many of those communities are having difficulty passing bond levies to upgrade their schools, so they're spending more and more of their operating money maintaining their buildings, which tends to divert resources out of the classroom for really an activity that could be argued that has little or no educational benefit to the students. The next slide shows a little more detail on declining versus stable versus rapidly growing districts. As I mentioned, roughly two-thirds of the districts in Oregon are losing enrollment. And as Senator Messerly pointed out, we do have a delay. It's only a one-year delay. But if you're a district that's been losing enrollment consistently over many years, that delay really is of no value to you. You get it. The value comes in the first year, but after that, you continue to decline.
And if I might also just interject a point here, too, that declining enrollment districts, I think, face some special issues with regard to maintaining and upgrading buildings, in that the maintenance aspect is one of the few budget areas that aren't mandated to be spent. And so I know that in my districts, the maintenance is often one of the things that gets deferred so that money can continue to go into the service providing sides of the budgets. And it has been more than once that I've seen districts be caught in situations where their deferred maintenance has caused them to have to deal with some major problems with roofs and structural issues like that that have been very problematic and very difficult for them to deal with.
Madam Chair, that's correct. Currently, the average spending on maintenance, operations and maintenance in Oregon schools is about $600 per student. But in some of the smaller districts, it's on the order of $1,500 to $2,000 per student. And that's money directly taken from other activities that when you have to spend it on maintenance, you can't spend it elsewhere. The next slide shows the growth over the last roughly 9 years, I believe we have data for here, in ESL and special ed students, and the growth here is really very dramatic, 286% over that period for ESL students. That's, I hope I'm remembering these numbers correctly, going from roughly 4,000 ESL students in 92-93 to on the order of 15,000 in 01-02. For special ed, a 29% growth over the period, from roughly 55,000 to 70-some thousand students. And I think it's important to point out, too, that the most rapid growth in special ed has been in the highest cost categories, particularly in autism. The growth rate has been much, much higher than special ed in general. And then finally, for contrast, over that period, the overall growth in student enrollment as measured by average daily membership has been 8%, or just slightly below 1% per year. So these other groups really are growing much, much more rapidly than students in general.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. This would just be an observation that where we are experiencing the dramatic growth in student enrollments in these categories, we could probably say that we've not experienced a matching of investment in the professional development that gives us the quality of professionals required to teach the students who are in these categories. So that's one of the issues we need your help pointing out along the way, if you would.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, Senator Gordley and I have discussed this in the past, and I want to agree very strongly with what she is saying. What we have seen with these numbers is a very dramatic change in the demographics of the state. The demographics of our teacher corps have not changed along parallel lines. So they are our teachers and administrators are faced with the challenge of adjusting instruction to meet the needs of a very rapidly changing population. In addition, an observation that we are trying to track, we don't have concrete information on this yet, but the funding available for that type of professional development is frequently tied to federal funding, particularly Title II of the No Child Left Behind Act. And there is a possibility that funding in the coming allocations would be tied to the 2000 census data as opposed to the 1990 or 1994 adjusted census data. What we suspect, and this will be the first time that 2000 census data would be used, these demographic shifts have impacted districts in different ways over the last decade. So if we reshuffle the allocation based on 2000 census data, It's very possible that some of the current funding would be reallocated in a different manner in districts throughout the state. That would be particularly the case where low-income or minority students have left a district to go to a neighboring district where you might see a shift in federal resources from one district to another as the money follows the student. This is something we're trying to track very carefully because, as Senator Gordley points out, obviously, if my demographics have changed, then my professional development needs to change, and then I need to have the funding to support that professional development activity.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You actually did a nice segue into my question concerning student populations. One of the things we've always tried to track pretty carefully was the number of students getting free reduced lunches and breakfasts, and the percentage of that in the population, because that's a pretty good indication of the poverty that children are coming out of and the poverty that our teachers have to deal with in trying to educate these kids. And I know which way that's moving in the state overall. I know in some districts it's going up, other districts it may be going down, but I like to see where it's going overall, see what our population of children look like that are coming into our schools.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we can certainly get that information for you. I can tell you that this is, however, one area where we are trying to construct a more complete database. This is an area that is sometimes difficult to gather on a school-by-school basis, which is the way we are now being asked to track this information. In smaller districts, this information might be simply handled by a local nutrition services manager of some type. In larger districts, this is all computerized and maintained on a network. So there's a lot of variance around the state in how these data are actually collected and reported. What we are doing is developing an integrated database that would collect them in a standard way across the district. But we can get you the information as best we have it right now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Reeder.
The next three slides take a look at where the education money is spent in Oregon. And you may recognize these slides. They're based on the data in the Secretary of State's audit recently conducted that compared Oregon to other states. And we've broken it down here into three categories. The first is what the Federal Department of Education calls instruction. It's a somewhat arbitrarily defined category that looks at really at spending that occurs only on activities in the classroom. So there are certain other activities that really are direct services to students, but they don't occur in the classroom, so they're not considered instruction. We'll take a little closer look at that in just a moment. What this shows is that Oregon spends about 59% of all of its spending for instruction, 52% of that on teachers and instructional assistants, and much smaller percentages for supplies, textbooks, and other services that are provide instruction in the classroom. It's important to point out, however, that Oregon is slightly below the national average in this percentage, the percentage of total spending that occurs for instruction. But the range of this percentage around the country is very narrow. It ranges from 56 or 57% up to 63 or 64%. It's not a wide range, and Oregon is right in the middle of that range. So we're really not unusual in that sense. We're just slightly below average in a situation where everybody is very close to the average.
Madam Chair.
Senator Mosley, before I give you the floor, just to note that we will be getting a presentation in the committee on the Secretary of State's audit, and it actually is very interesting information. We received the report in the audit committee over the interim, and it makes, I think, an interesting comparison of Oregon's system to the national picture.
Thank you, Madam Chair. as we on the committee know, three or four weeks ago, when the TSPC was before our committee, there was a discussion about the requirement of a master's degree to be certified as a teacher. And I think we were told then, but I don't have it in front of me now, I'd be interested as to when that mandate was implemented, what that has cost the state in additional personnel costs, and if there is any way of documenting whether we're getting better teaching because of that or not. I think it'd be important.
Mr. Burke, do you have any 40,000-foot comments on that?
First of all, we'll be happy to get the information, and we are aware of the conversation with TSPC. The research on the impact of teaching is very clear, that the instructional improvement that we would like to see in students comes from two sources: improvement in the content knowledge of the teacher and improvement of the pedagogical knowledge of the teacher. So the addition of a master's degree, Senator Mesley, gets to one half of that equation. It increases the content knowledge of the teacher, and certainly the research, the national research, would indicate that that would improve the instructional skill or the instructional impact of the teacher. The other piece of that coin, of course, is pedagogical knowledge, and the two have to go hand in hand. So it is not a direct correlation. It's hard to nail down that just the increase of the master's degree would necessarily have a direct impact on improving instruction or the outcome of instruction. But we would assume, certainly from the research, that better content knowledge would lead to better instruction on the part of our teachers.
Thank you.
Mr. Reeder.
The next slide shows a category that the U.S. Department of Education has termed support services. I think if you look at the first two categories there and the final one, transportation, those really are, even though they're not considered instruction and they often don't occur in the classroom, they are services supplied directly to students. They're not administrative costs. They are services that benefit students. So that's really close to 15% of spending on those categories. And as Superintendent Castillo pointed out, administration really is quite a small share of total spending. School-level administration, which is principals, assistant principals, and their staffs, their office staffs, are about 6.4%. And district-level administration, which would include the superintendents and their staffs, 1.7%. And then added to that, business service activities such as human resources, payroll, and so forth, and building maintenance and operations, which we talked about earlier, is not an insignificant amount of spending for most districts. And given that, as the chair pointed out, that many districts look there first when they need to make cuts, we have a quite high level of deferred maintenance in schools in Oregon and nationally, too, that down the road really will result in higher costs for maintaining our school buildings. And finally, the category, again, somewhat arbitrarily named non-instruction, although that's not quite, not very, very descriptive, includes food services and other categories, which we typically call enterprise services, or which are activities such as school stores or concessions at sporting events and so forth, where schools and districts do incur expenses, but they also generate revenue. In some cases, these are activities that are self-supporting, and their revenue would be shown on the revenue side of the equation. But again, quite a small category in the overall picture. I think what this tells us is really we're not very much different than districts in other states. What really has distinguished Oregon is that, as Pat pointed out, the performance of our students really has, even in the face of declining school funding, has increased in significant ways, and that really is what sets us apart from a number of other states, is that we've enjoyed improved performance by our students in a time when we've really not had any increases. Actually, we've seen decreases in funding levels.
Madam Chair.
Senator Mesley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sure this is included someplace, but I don't find it. My question is the cost of the extracurricular activities, sports, other types of student groups, that where does that come out in your figures here?
Madam Chair, Senator Mesley, that would be included in the support services category. It's not considered instruction. I don't know precisely which of these categories it is likely to be in one of the first two categories here on the support services table. I certainly can get that information for you. The database initiative has information specifically on extracurricular activities, so we do have what we think is good data in those categories.
Madam Chair, if I could have a follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it would be interesting, I think, to just, I'm not saying whether it's good or bad, I think it's very good, but just so we know, and maybe even expand that to what are the mandated instruction, required instructions, and what is not required.
I'm wondering if this may be a good place to stop. We have about 6 minutes left, and I think that you're going to be going into a discussion of the progress that the system has made over time. And I think that this is an area where the committee will have a lot of questions and a lot of statements to make. So with that, if you have nothing that would take less than about 2 minutes to say.
Madam Chair, we have an answer to the question raised by Representative March about special education spending, if I could at least get that on the record. Representative March, if the federal government had provided the full amount, now you may remember the original authorization of IDEA called for a 40% spending level. If that amount had been provided in the 2001-03 biennium, Oregon would have received approximately $363.8 million. The actual IDE funding in Oregon during the same period of time, 2001-03, was $159.7 million. The difference, or the shortfall from 40%, was $204.1 million.
Another broken promise.
Does that answer your question, Representative March?
Several children left behind, yes.
Yes. A very frustrating topic to deal with. With that, I will close the public hearing for today on House Bill 5016. Just to have the committee members be very aware that we will be having public testimony on Wednesday evening starting at 6 o'clock and then again on Thursday. And we will continue the public hearing on House Bill 5016 beginning at 8:30 tomorrow morning. And having no further business before the committee today, we will adjourn.
Thank you.